morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start out today's program with my usual summertime rant, Summer Gold Rush, which I wrote for my old newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted national resources, whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravished in a century. Sultans of fun replaced loggers and fisher people. Shopping malls, motels, restaurants, and boutique bars restructure the Oregon coast. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall and its beachfront into huge cubes of high-rise motels. Astoria hustles its colorful history and Carpenter Gothic houses that quilt its hills to draw tourists from the beach towns, and in a very real sense draws affluent residents who avoid the more gaudy tourist traps. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed, which, of course, includes residents unable to abide or afford the shifting economics. Tourism has an insidious habit of devouring what it seeks and distorts any authenticity it purports to represent. Amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is rapidly slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the pinball machines and snow cone litter, lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town. A town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a person's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small-town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss those cosmetic compromised by developers can remedy or replace. And that was something I wrote, and several times have revised it from 1988, my annual summertime rant. And now, by Carolyn Y. Johnson. Scientists map one of Earth's top hazards in the Pacific Northwest. A catastrophic earthquake and tsunami will one day hit the Pacific Northwest as tectonic plates slip at the Cascadia subduction zone. And this is written by Carolyn Y. Johnson for the Washington Post. Scientists have mapped one of the most hazardous spots on the globe in unprecedented detail. A 600-mile geologic boundary just off the Pacific Northwest coast. Along this fraught stretch, called the Cascadia Subduction Zone, two pieces of the Earth's crust slide against each other, building up stresses capable of unleashing a catastrophic 9.0 magnitude earthquake and generating a tsunami with waves as high as 40 feet. Because scientists don't know when that day will arrive, they prepare by trying to better understand the geological state of play. To do that, a 235-foot ship cruised for 41 days along the coast of Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia in summer of 2021, sending sound waves deep into the ocean and recording echoes with a streamer, a 9-mile-long waterproof cable containing 1,200 specialized microphones. Similar to how doctors use ultrasound to see inside the body, they used the data to construct a comprehensive map of the underwater geology in a study published in the Journal of Science Advances just recently. The new resource will help scientists understand the range of earthquake and tsunami scenarios and help policymakers devise building codes that protect people. The entire area, which stretches from Northern California to Vancouver Island, is at risk. But the scientists found that the geometry of the fault off the coast of Washington, where the fault is flat and smooth, closer to the surface, and extends further onshore, may be particularly at risk. I'm excited to use these results to make sure the shaking estimates I'm producing are as accurate as they can be, said Aaron Worth, a seismologist with the United States Geological Survey, who was not involved in the study. For hundreds of years, the Cascadia subduction zone has been quiet. But on January 26, 1700, the Earth shook. Japanese history records show an orphan, and that's in quotes, tsunami traveled across the Pacific with no preceding quake. Native American oral histories describe earth shaking and marine flooding. Analysis of tree rings from ghost forests that died when the land abruptly subsided helped scientists pin down the date. Scientists estimate that on that day, more than three centuries ago, a magnitude 9 quake struck. This fault zone is hazardous because it is a megathrust, and that's a quote, fault. One piece of the Earth's crust, a tectonic plate called the Juan de Fuca plate, dives down beneath the North American continental plate. These plates move at the rate fingernails grow, but also get stuck and build up stresses. The 2011 Tohoku earthquake in Japan and the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami occurred at subduction zones. But to understand earthquakes, details matter, and seismologists typically learn those details by observing smaller earthquakes that pop off subduction zones. Since Cascadia has been eerily quiet in recent human history, many specifics remain fuzzy. We had models for what the fault zone looked like, but they were based on no data for much of the margin and little bits of data and old quality data, said Suzanne Carbate, a marine seismologist at the Columbia Climate School's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, who led the study. It's kind of like you had a Coke bottle over your eyes and they've been removed and you got the proper prescription. Now you can see where the fault zone is, and not surprisingly, the fault surface is way more complex than the pictures we had before, said Ms. Lamont Doherty. The new study is expected to be the first of many scientific papers out of the new data, but already scientists have made a few key findings. There is a particularly flat and smooth portion of the fault spanning the state of Washington up to southern Vancouver Island. At another similar fault system across the world, those areas often cause the largest and most destructive earthquakes. That section of a fault is also shallow and closer to the surface than previous models, which could make it more hazardous, Worth said. Scientists also found four segments along the fault, deepening the question about whether the whole fault will go at once or whether segments could rupture individually. That's the messy question, where the answer is more like sometimes it does one thing and sometimes another, said Harold Tobin, a seismologist at the University of Washington and an author of the paper. Either scenario would constitute a major natural disaster. Perhaps the difference between one magnitude 9 and two magnitude 8 earthquakes. Tobin pointed to a pair of massive earthquakes in Japan in 1944 and 1946, in which two different segments of a fault ruptured in short order, both causing deadly tsunamis. And that was Scientists Map One of the Earth's Top Hazards in the Pacific Northwest. And now, something I wrote. Trees are us. We read and hear about the massive destruction of the rainforests of Asia and South America, yet somehow find it difficult to equate with our own clear-cutting of forests in this country. The great North American forest has virtually disappeared in little more than two centuries from the East Coast to the Pacific, from the great conifer forests of the North to the hardwoods of the South. In particular, a huge swath across the top of the nation, from Maine to Oregon. Little is left of Oregon's old forests and the forests of Northern California and Washington, and what little remains is increasingly under threat. Less than 10% of old-growth timber remains in the Pacific Northwest, which includes British Columbia. Though the forests of B.C. are intensely logged, they are not in U.S. jurisdiction, even though they are a vital part of the region's ecosystem. The economy of the Northwest is largely based on forest products. The problems and complexity pertaining to forest use focus on employment, endangered species, shrinking habitat, land erosion, and water pollution, disastrous fires that consume hundreds of thousands of acres each season and kill animals and firefighters, climate change, methods and extent of logging, especially clear-cutting of old-growth forests, access and use of public forest lands. The never-quenched hunger of the timber industry has butchered its own lands, replacing them, when they do, with inferior and less profitable monocultural tree farms. Incredibly, the timber companies demand as almost their divine right the public forests, and as they log off more and more public timber, they demand more of what is left. Astoria is in the same situation in microcosm, trees versus money, the threatened long-range loss of local ecosystem in exchange for short-term profit. Local citizens have, in Astoria, a wonderful forest, something most cities lack and many wish to have. This small remnant of a much larger forest on the hills above the Columbia River is instrumental to the quality of life many of us wish for ourselves and our successors. Others do not share sympathy with that vision. Trees are economical units to them, to be harvested to meet market demands without consideration for aesthetics or ecological value. The Pacific Northwest is in the same shape as Astoria. Its resources have been ravaged, and the greed for what remains will not end until all of it is gone. Trees, fish, and everything else despoiled for single-generation profit, one generation succeeding another in its desire to exploit whatever the market demands. Yet the glory days of logging are at an end. We have a simple dramatic choice to either allow loggers to keep their jobs until they have cut down the remaining old growth forests or keep what is left at the cost of their jobs, which they will use anyway when the last big trees are cut down. Automation has accounted for most timber jobs, contrary to claims by the timber industry. Also shipping raw logs to Asia and shutting down American mills because of cheaper costs. Timber companies and environmentalists push at each other with little inclination to compromise their positions. I favor the environmentalists. The loggers have had their day. They have denuded our forests and showed little inclination to replace what was lost on their own lands, and as a result are voracious in their demands of a mandate of public forests for their chainsaws. And here is a paradox. Not among managers who see trees as nothing but ciphers on ledgers, but in the attitude of proud roughneck loggers who regard themselves as woodsmen, men who profess to love the forests they destroy and refuse to quit until nothing is left. When the last big trees are gone and the poor grade second and third growth timber shortens the ledgers, the managers will diversify their portfolios and dismiss the woodsmen who created their wealth and make restaurant dishwashers and busboys out of them. Without the forests of Asia and the Americas, we bequeath our descendants an arid world, a hot greenhouse. No shade to shield us from the sun's ultraviolet rays. We have virtually ruined uppermost atmosphere ozone. Water systems dry up without the cooler, moist climates of forests. Biological diversity disappears. Marine life vanishes. Maybe only hallucinogenic drugs will recall the ancient symbiosis with Earth before our species moved out alone to dominate our home planet through obliteration of all that made it home. Yet we might be emerging from a long period of exploiting Earth's natural stocks to the realized necessity of preserving them. The blatant abuse and misuse of nature might now be reversed as ever-increasing numbers of humans wish to preserve the remaining ancient forests that were young when Shakespeare was alive, and which have survived in their own unique and experienced responses to the conditions of their naturally symbiotic lives. A lesson we should learn from them. And that was something I wrote. And now, in a first, federal government acknowledges harms of dams on Native American communities. The federal government has released a report that for the first time acknowledges the harms that dams in the Pacific Northwest have, quote, inflicted and continue to inflict, unquote, on Native American tribes. The report, released this month by the Interior Department, details the, quote, historic, ongoing, and cumulative damage and injustice that the federal dams on the Columbia River have caused and continue to cause to tribal nations, the Biden administration said in a statement. It is also starting a task force to pursue restoring wild salmon and other native fish to the river's basin and to expand tribally sponsored clean energy production. Large hydroelectric dams were built throughout the basin at the beginning of the 20th century, and according to the report, flooded thousands of acres of land, sacred sites, and ancestral burial grounds. They also transformed the ecosystem, including by blocking fish from migrating. Together with leaders of four Columbia River Basin tribes and the governors of Oregon and Washington, the Biden administration formally announced the $1 billion plan in February. The report acknowledged that federal dams and reservoirs in the Columbia River Basin, which covers nearly 260,000 miles across seven states, had affected all local tribes, but focused on the repercussions of 11 dams on tribes it described as the most immediately affected. Several of the tribes could not be immediately reached for comment. Brenda Mallory, the chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, said the task force would work to develop affordable, reliable, and clean energy for the region while addressing the grave harms inflicted by the federal government on the local Native American communities. President Biden recognizes that to confront injustice, we must be honest about history, even when doing so is difficult, she said, describing the report as a step toward overcoming the past. And that was by Leva Albeck-Rivka, and she wrote this for the New York Times. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. Does America really want an American president who personally and corruptly 4F'd himself out of a war through unwarranted class privilege and personal cowardice, who absurdly boasts he would have been a hero had he gone to Vietnam? I would conjecture his farcical boast must anger Vietnam veteran volunteers and draftees alike, who most likely regard him not only a coward, but also a counterfeit and deeply flawed person whose claim to majesty is absolutely un-American. Trump's claim of majesty is a real attempt at dictatorial annihilation of democracy through democratic means of seizing the presidential throne, which he certainly attempted to do the last time he failed to be reelected. It might be wise for all Americans to study Trump's Project 2025. He virtually lays out why he should be anointed America's Hitler.